Hello, Dr. John Malloy. Thank you so much again for agreeing to be on the Political Impact today.
Oh, wonderful to be here.
Awesome. So we can just start by introducing yourself and how you got to Laurier.
Sure. My name is John Malloy. I actually have two roles at Laurier. I'm at Martin Luther University College, that wonderful building across the parking lot by the library, which is a federated institution with Laurier. For students may not realize this, but it actually was the founding institution of Laurier. Many people may have a recollection that we used to be called Waterloo Lutheran University. There's a Lutheran Seminary was the founding institution, and we're sort of the continuation of that ceremony. So it's Martin Luther University College. And there I'm an assistant professor of public ethics and also the director of the Center for Public Ethics. At the same time, I'm the practitioner in residence in the Department of Political Science. Amazing. How did I come to Laurier? Yes. Is a very long story, I guess, or I was going to say interesting story, but maybe that's for your listeners to decide. I was a politician who retired in 2014, and I imagine we'll get into that a little bit more in the interview. And I had to figure out what to do next. I come from an academic background. I have a doctorate. I have this experience in politics. I also am someone who's always been very, very interested in religion and faith. I was born and raised a Roman Catholic and continue to practice my faith while being a politician. I've always been someone who's been interested in the intersection between someone's personal faith and politics. So I was delighted when I had an opportunity to come to Luther and essentially explore those issues as a member of the faculty. At the same time, as someone who's was involved in politics for many, many years, I had this opportunity to be in political science and serve in an advisory role to students. We run workshops, guest lectures, that sort of thing. So I came to Laurier, Luther and Laurier proper in 2015. And, you know, sort of cliche alert here, I can't believe that it's 6.5 years later, but I've enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's a huge accomplishment for you. What a career that you've had so far in your life. That's amazing. Do you have a specific moment that you recall that sparked your interest in national or local politics, or you were always interested in politics, even at age six?
No, actually, I always say at age 12, I was a page in the Ontario legislature, and I've had students and certainly encountered students who we're part of that program. It still exists. Students in grades 7 and 8 will go down to the Ontario legislature. In my day, it was for a long time. It was actually for 6 weeks. Now it's about 3 weeks where they'll actually be on the floor of the legislature, serve as messengers, get water for politicians, that sort of thing. It's a very popular program, and it certainly gives you insights into politics. And I was hooked at age 12. I always joke with my class, just think 15 years ago, and every year that joke gets a bigger laugh, but it was many, many years ago, but that certainly sparked my interest. I moved into high school. Of course, this was the end of elementary school, where I became involved in youth politics. I became a member of the Young Liberal Party, part of the Liberal Party. And then continued on with that in the beginning of undergrad. I was involved in politics, but then discovered about second or third year that the Liberal Party was not a degree-granting institution. So I actually stepped back a bit and focused more on my studies. But that's how my interest started, and it certainly developed, and I've kept that interest up until this very day.
Wow, that's amazing. And that program still exists today?
Oh, yeah, the PAGE program does. And it was what was really interesting. You know, we haven't got into my political experience, but I ended up sitting in the Ontario legislature. And when I arrived, there were several members of provincial parliament who had been there when I was a PAGE. So that was I found it very humorous. They, I don't think, found it as humorous because it just sort of brought home maybe that they had been there for a long time. And, you know, there were other members who were pages. It was actually maybe a training camp for people who want to go into provincial politics. And I remember being on a special committee of three members, and two of us had been pages, and the other member had, in fact, both of us had got water for him and delivered messages. So I never tired of reminding him of that, though he certainly tired of hearing it from me, but that everyone in the room had brought him water at some point.
Wow. Talk about a full circle moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just shows you how, you know, for some people, they become their whole life to be in the legislature.
Yeah, awesome. And then what courses do you teach now currently at Laurier? Do you have a favorite that you love to teach?
Well, I basically teach one at a time, so I don't need to have a favorite, I guess. I'll talk about Luther and then talk a little bit about political science. At Luther, my main interest is public theology. How do people bring their faith to the wider world, especially a world that's secular, a world that's diverse, a world where there's lots of people with no beliefs, and of course people with strong beliefs, but they may be from a different denomination or from a different faith tradition altogether. So that's the area that I focus on. I teach in the undergrad program there, which is Christian Studies and Global Citizenship. It is offered through Luther, but gives students a Laurier degree, and certainly all our courses are open to any Laurier student. It is a Laurier course. You get Laurier credit. I mean, it's very seamless. So I teach the foundational course in public theology. GC 201, for anyone who's interested, is offered every fall. And it's both for Laurier students and then students who are in the program. It's a mandatory course. Then in the winter term, I alternate one term or one winter, which is the one coming up. I do something called the Canadian Questions GC 221, which takes a look at pressing Canadian issues through a faith lens. So how do people of faith deal with some of the issues facing our country right now? And obviously in a post-COVID-19, hopefully it's post-COVID, nearly post-COVID-19 world, we've been confronted with so many, you know, everything from racism to Indigenous reconciliation, economic inequality, climate change. So we'll be looking at those issues. And then the alternate years, so next winter, I teach a course called Politics and Faith in an Age of Anger. And someone was joking with me that maybe, you know, when am I going to have to change the name? And I said, I think people will be angry for many, many years. But it's really looking at, in a very, very focused way, this intersection between faith and politics in an era which I think everyone would agree has become very polarized and has become very, for lack of a better word, very angry. People are very upset with each other, with the system. And my question is, well, does faith have a role in that? And we take a look at it from a theological point of view, from a historical point of view. And I think students are always surprised to find out how much faith has played a role in the history of our country. And then I call it a practical point of view. You know, students today, how if you do have a certain faith interest or faith tradition, follow of a certain faith tradition, what does that mean for you as a voter? What does that mean for you as an activist? What does that mean for you as someone who might want to put their name on a ballot or be involved in someone's campaign? So that's the Luther side. And then on the poli-sci side, I'm practitioner in residence, so I don't teach a formal course, but I do offer a series of workshops to fourth year and master's students where they can get a certificate, a practical politics certificate. And we look, as the name would suggest, at a lot of practical political issues, everything from the role of media to the role that politics plays in terms of policy development. We're involved in the model parliament every year. So it's a nice series of programs for students, and not a lot of heavy lifting. I think they enjoy it. You know, we don't have homework or exams or anything, but a chance to get to know a little bit better the political system. And then I do a fair amount of guest lecturing and meeting with students individually and things like that.
Oh, awesome. And just for transparency purposes, I am enrolled in Dr. Malloy's GC 201 this semester, and I am really enjoying it. So let's talk a little bit more.
I didn't know whether I'm supposed to mention that.
Just for transparency purposes.
Totally transparent, yes.
Absolutely. And I definitely want to be an advocate to say that it is a really good class and that I encourage other students to take it.
All right. I guess we should do the interview after the course is over.
Maybe.
Right? Maybe you've created a conflict of interest.
I promise you, my distinction of the course would not change. But let's talk a little bit more about your career in politics. I think that sometimes it can be very simplistic, the public viewpoint of how to get into politics and how to start a campaign. But I do think it's a little bit more complex than that. And I would love to get your take on how you got involved and decided to run for office and how you eventually became the MPP of Kitchener Center.
Sure. I mean, it was a bit of a long trajectory. I had this great interest in politics. I studied history and economics. And when I finished at the end of fourth year, I'm sure many listeners have this experience now as you're thinking about graduation, what to do next. And because I love politics, I actually went and worked, ironically, at Queen's Park as a political assistant. And you know, for many students interested in politics, graduating students, there are opportunities, and it can be a very rewarding job, an interesting job. They tend to be very short-term jobs. I mean, a few people have made it into a career, but most people, it's a sort of a nice starting point after graduation. So I did that for a few years and then went to graduate school and did a master's and then a doctorate. And while I was finishing up my doctorate, and this is going way back hundreds and hundreds of years ago to 1993, the rumblings, back then we didn't have set election dates, but there were rumblings of an election in Canada. Brian Mulroney, who had been the prime minister, had stepped down to be replaced by Kim Campbell, who's up to this date our only female prime minister, perhaps not that well known because she wasn't around that long. But the expectation was there was going to be an election that fall. And I had some friends who were working on the national campaign, and I was asked if I wanted to come and be involved with it and take a leave of absence from my doctorate. So I negotiated a leave of absence, arrived in Ottawa. Again, very different times because elections we didn't know the date, but it was eventually called. They were, by tradition back then, much longer. Now, you know, we did have an election a few years ago that was very, very long, but we hadn't done that in a while. Now, you know, the most recent one was just several weeks. This was 2 months. So I spent 2 months working on the national campaign and then went back. I always say the smartest thing ever, I went back to finish my doctorate because there were all sorts of opportunities. It was a very, just to bring everyone up to speed, in 1993, the federal Liberals won a huge majority government under Jean Chrétien. It was a very exciting time to be involved in politics. And certainly having worked on the national campaign, I was part of that team that was going to be part of the new government. So I went back, finished my doctorate, came back to Canada about a year later. I did my studies overseas. And from there, started an 8-year career on Parliament Hill. I worked for a series of cabinet ministers, the Minister of Industry. And in 1995, there was a referendum in Quebec on independence, which the federal government obviously was opposed to it and nearly lost, came within 50,000 votes of the independence, pro-independence forces winning. So Prime Minister Chrétien brought two cabinet ministers or two individuals from Quebec to Ottawa and put them in the cabinet to help to lead the unity file. And one of them was a gentleman by the name of Stéphane Dion, who was made Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs. And his job was to try to make sure that Quebec would stay in the fold. So I was quite excited. I got a call out of the blue, seeing if, this Anglophone kid from Kitchener wanted to go over and be part of his team. And the reason why is there was a recognition that Quebec independence was not simply a Quebec issue. It was a national issue, and they wanted to have staff that had insights from other parts of the country. So they wanted, someone with a strong perspective of what was going on in British Columbia and the prairies and the Maritimes. And then when it came to me, Ontario, and being a little bit of a liaison with the Ontario scene, how we could make sure. I mean, this was a pretty frightening time for Canada, because we had come close to breaking up, and it has happened. I mean, in Czechoslovakia broke up. We see what's happening in Scotland. It's not out of the question that we could absolutely have seen the breakup. So it was a very exciting time to be with him. And from there, after 1997, I worked in the federal campaign again. And from there, I was recruited to go work for the Prime Minister, partly because I was an Anglophone kid from Kitchener who had worked on the National Unity file in a Francophone office. I mean, I had that kind of mix that they liked, because I understood. I thought I understood. You never know if you do 100%, right, but I thought I understood Quebec politics, and certainly had that perspective from Ontario and even the rest of Canada. So I had the pleasure of working for Prime Minister Chrétien for about 5 or 6 years. And then an opportunity came up in 2002. There was certainly, again, no fixed election dates, but there was a big push to have not a push, but a feeling that we were going to have a provincial election very soon. And I was approached to see if I'd put my name on the ballot back home in my home riding of Kitchener Center. So that is a very, very long answer to your question. But in 2003, I was elected as the MPP for Kitchener Center.
Were there any significant, you spoke about on a national level, an accomplishment of being a part of the unity file with Quebec. But were there any specific parliamentary accomplishments or legislations that you got the chance to be a part of and debate with that you're proud of today?
At Queen's Park or in Ottawa, or both, maybe? I don't know.
Well, I assume that the Ottawa one would be in relation to the referendum.
I mean, Ottawa, I was working for a politician, and
right.
So maybe
one that you got to be involved with when you were an MPP.
Yeah, I mean, as an MPP, I served for 4 years in the as a private member, as a backbencher, whatever term you want to use. And then in 2007, after the election, I became a cabinet minister. I was minister, ironically, considering where I am today, of training colleges and universities. So I did amazing. That for 4 years, but also at I think about 3 years into it, was asked if I'd take over the Ministry of Research and Innovation. So I actually had both ministries. And then after the 2011 election, there was a minority government in Ontario, and how long were we going to last? Very similar to what's going on in Ottawa, actually similar in the sense it was a minority, but not very similar, because the opposition, didn't have the troubles that we're seeing in Ottawa, and there was a very real chance of an election. So the person in charge of sorting it all out is the government house leader. And we all joked what poor soul would become government house leader. And lo and behold, I got the call saying that they wanted me to be government house leader. So I became government house leader in the minority government. I also, at the same time, and this was, I think, an extraordinary privilege. It was one of the toughest assignments I've ever had. I was made Minister of Community and Social Services, which is a minister responsible for social assistance, issues around domestic violence, At that point, issues around persons with disabilities, that's moved since then to a different portfolio. Something called the Family Responsibility Office, which is responsible for enforcing settlements over a marriage breakdown. Pretty heavy list of issues that fell on that minister's desk. Very serious issues around people in crisis. It was an extraordinary privilege to have that job. You ask about what I proud of. It certainly was a time when we took a look at social assistance and hopefully steered the ship trying to bring some reforms, as I had done in training colleges and universities. And that was a much more exciting ministry, or not exciting, but maybe perhaps a little bit more positive ministry, because you're dealing with students and you're dealing with what I think is a very, very good post-secondary education system here in the province of Ontario. It was a time of a great deal of growth. At Laurier, the Lazaritas building, I remember, was a huge announcement and quite exciting for everyone. Certainly, more money for student assistance. One of the things I was very proud of is that we dramatically expanded the student assistance programs in the province of Ontario. And at the risk of, not at the risk, I will be partisan and say I was very disappointed to see a lot of that work was undone in the last few years, because I certainly tried to make sure that students were always at the forefront of the work that I did as minister.
Yeah, it seems like you definitely had a very successful time in office, though. It seems like you reached all different scopes and issues.
Yeah, and I mean, towards the end, I actually became, I said partisan alert, maybe this is boring alert or not, I don't know. I was made Minister of Government Services, which, no one outside of government understands or knows about, but the Minister of Government Services, and again, they all change, so the title may change, right, but it's a different portfolio now. I was very much in charge of how do you put it? I want to say running the government, but I don't mean running the government like the premier runs the government, running the government in terms of, and again, perhaps it's boring, but things like procurement, things like negotiating with the unions, things like, so basically making sure that the government can function, everything from computer systems to, a lot of the major purchases, rules and regulations around how government operates. And, as I say it out loud, maybe it does sound very boring, but it was a behind the scenes look that certainly gave me a lot of insight into government, how government, I was involved in the process to make the provincial budget or to put together the provincial budget. And all these types of things were very much part of my education. And again, not something people think of government, you think of, well, the Minister of Education or the Minister of Defense or something, but there is a lot of this behind the scenes work. And, the provincial government's about $160 billion operation. So right, there are a lot of hardworking people that make sure that it can set out to do what it has to do, whether vaccines or make sure universities are funded, or make sure our provincial police work. There's a lot that goes on. So that was my final portfolio, as well as being house leader. And then in 2014, despite my advanced years, I had a very young family, and I just said enough's enough, and I chose not to run then, but was very pleased that, the Liberals still won in Kitchener Centre. And I was hopefully able to sort of quietly take a step back.
Is that, I think that that part of the mechanics of politics, it does go to be underappreciated. It is such an integral part to the functioning of our government, and all aspects of government are important. And they play a role into making what it is today. And the structure of government and making sure everything runs smoothly makes sure that politics actually reflects our values at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I say this with great pride in all the students who I talk to. I mean, they want to get involved in public service. I think it's amazing. They all want to work on policy, and I understand why. But you know, I have a joke with a colleague in political science. Who's gonna give out the vaccines? What we've seen over the past few years has been that yes, policy has been very important, but to actually execute that policy, it has, you know, required a lot of work by a lot of very talented people. And there's a role for individuals interested in government or politics in that kind of execution, in making sure that things get done, and never underestimate it. Right. Part of the reason when politicians make these grand promises they can't carry through is because oftentimes there's just not the capacity in government to do it. And right. That's why, you know, working on some of these big issues can actually be a very, very rewarding experience. And yes, you're not the policy analyst, but you're making a real difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that it goes without being said that any part of being part of public service is being part of the solution. I would like to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit more about what you focus on as a professor and what you focused on getting your doctorate. So as you said before, you work on public theology. So if we can talk to the listeners a little bit more about the definition of public theology and why it's important to study the relationship between faith and politics, especially within a 21st century scope.
Sure. I mean, the way to think about public theology, I should ask you see if you've been paying attention in class. There's two ways to talk about public theology. One is from the viewpoint of a person of faith who is looking around at the world. One of my favorite quotes comes from the American, and I won't call him a theologian, he's more of a Christian activist, Jim Wallace. And he always says that there are aspects of your faith that are personal, but there's no aspects of your faith that are private. And the fact is, for a person of faith, you can't simply check that part of your identity at the door. If you're a devout Roman Catholic, you don't even be devout if you're a Roman Catholic or you're a Lutheran or an Anglican, or if you're a Muslim or a Jew or a Buddhist, that's part of who you are. And right. The idea that as you encounter the world, you should leave all that part of you at home makes absolutely no sense. So there's that side of it, the perspective from a person of faith, and then there's the perspective from society. What do we do with all these individuals who associate with a faith tradition or may just consider themselves spiritual but not religious, people of deep convictions who believe in, you know, sort of a truth that's out there that's transcendent of them? That's all part of who they are. So how do we welcome them into the political arena, the business arena, general discussions that we're having as a society, as we're faced with so many questions? And I mentioned this earlier, in the post-COVID-19 world, good grief. I mean, everything from racism to economic inequality, Indigenous reconciliation, how we treat seniors. How do we tap into people of faith to allow them to make a contribution, but also recognize that we're a secular society? There's nothing wrong with that. I'm very much in favor of being a secular society. And we're also a society with many, many different faith traditions. So these are the two questions, or perhaps the one question, the two sides of the coin that I look at in my work. I'm very, very interested, and people won't be at all surprised by this. I'm very, very interested in politicians and how they deal, I shouldn't say deal, but how they bring their faith, their religion, their denomination, their tradition that they follow, how do they bring that to their role, considering they're asked to represent a diverse group of people as a representative, and also they're part of a government that represents, right, you know, all parts of the country and that sort of thing. So that's been a lot of my work in areas of research over the past couple of years.
Right. And I'd love to dive a little bit deeper on being a secular society. We did touch on the differences between Quebec and Ontario a little bit that you got to see firsthand during the 1995 referendum. But I was going to say one of the bigger challenges, I think, of modern public ethics is being so secular. And where does that line fall? I mean, one of the most controversial examples is Bill 21 in Quebec and not having displaying religious symbols. What do you think is, how do we tackle that? And how does public ethics challenge that kind of balance?
Sure. I think the starting point is that secularism, there's not one definition. And right. My understanding, definition of secularism is different than what you see in Quebec with Bill 21. Secularism can take on different forms. I mean, there are definitions. Perhaps the greatest living expert is Charles Taylor, believe it or not, a Canadian philosopher who's, we always think, well, Canada's just we're not a little dot in the map, but maybe an insignificant part of the map. But in fact, we do have some well-known thinkers in this area. And Charles Taylor is probably one of the most well-known living philosophers today. And I mean, Charles Taylor can come up with some pretty basic definitions of secularism that you can go out into the public sphere, into politics and government, and not encounter God or talk of God, which is fair enough. But there's different ways that manifests itself. One way is an actual negativity towards religion. Some will talk about wanting to emancipate people from religion. There is an attitude that people who are religious are not that bright, are prejudiced, are a little bit backwards. There is a view that many faith traditions are misogynistic or homophobic, and that the best thing that we could do as a society is actually free people from the shackles of religion. You're seeing it in France, of course, much bigger than anywhere, where I've shared this in class, I think, Kelsey, that these bizarre situations where certain Muslim women will wear, I believe it's called a burkini, where you wear a very, very modest bathing costume to go in the water, because that aligns with your religious beliefs. And in fact, they've been outlawed in France. So you'll have these bizarre situations of women being given tickets for wearing very modest bathing outfits on beaches where people are topless. I mean, it's beyond bizarre, but the only way to think about it is they're trying to do a service. They're basically saying to these people, you have no, your religion is backwards. It's oppressing you. We need to liberate you from it. I would never say that Bill 21 has gone that far, but I think there are elements in it. Certainly, I've never seen a government spokesperson talk about emancipating women, but certainly a lot of the people who were in favor of Bill 21 spoke that way. And in that famous or infamous exchange during the federal leaders debate, the English one, with the Bloc Québécois leader, he said, until we get rid of religion, or until we, I forget the exact words, but he mentioned oppression of women or freeing women. So that's certainly there in Bill 21. But I think there are, and people won't be shocked when I say, I think it's a much more healthier way to view secularism, to think of a different approach, which is that we are a society made up of a whole range of different people, different beliefs, different ideas. And religious beliefs are part of that. As much as someone who considers himself atheist or agnostic, what is the role of our state? What's the role of our political system? And you know, our my favorite quote on what's politics actually comes from a theologian, Luke Bretherton, who's a British theologian, who now lives in the United States. And he says, politics is trying to build a common life together with people with friends, strangers, and enemies. And that's what it's all about. We have to find a way to live together. And within that context, I see the role of a secular state, not to ever take sides, not to say, well, you know, Canada's a Christian country or a Jewish country or a Muslim country or an atheist country for that matter, but to create opportunities for exchange, to create opportunities where people feel free to present their perspective, oftentimes from a, well, in this context, from a religious point of view, to be heard and to have it considered. When you put it that way, it sounds fairly reasonable, but I would argue that we live in a society where oftentimes religious voices are shut down, not because of what they're saying, but just because, you know, we don't want to hear from you. You might upset us. You might raise subjects that we don't want to hear. So, you know, it's a struggle, but I think it's a conversation worth having.
Yeah, and I think that it's interesting that you touch on that, but maybe to put it simply, is it that people of different denominations need to find common ground? Is that how we work together into creating political policies that align with the majority values? Or is it to debunk one another and to debate each other on this is my way and this is your way? Or is that even possible? To debate value.
Yeah, if I had the answers to all those questions, I'd be, I don't know, I wouldn't be on the talk show circuit. I'd probably I'd be accepting my Nobel Peace Prize. It's a little bit of both, of course. Right. First of all, we have to respect each other. And yes, we have to find common ground. And it works always. It's not simply between different faith traditions. It's between all of us. It's between people with no faith tradition and you know, people who consider themselves very hardcore atheists or agnostic and all those faith traditions. There is this issue of you need to present, and you know, now we're getting into the weeds. It gets tougher sometimes depending on the topic area, but you have to present your beliefs in a way that is accessible to others. And by that, I mean, you can't simply say the Bible, you know, and people make fun of religious people for saying things like this. Well, the Bible says this is true, and it's true because the Bible is true. You may believe that, and that's absolutely fine, but you need a way to translate it, I guess, to other people in society. But you know, we're constantly having to do that. You know, we live in an era where Indigenous issues have become top of a mind, and you know, oftentimes you'll often hear, and particularly, I shouldn't say particularly, but certainly, Laurie, there's examples of lectures and seminars and speakers you can have about how do you take Indigenous wisdom and make it accessible to the settler community, and also are there messages and learnings in there that we could apply to it? That's accepted. I mean, people embrace that. People are very enthusiastic about it. So, you know, what about other traditions? You know, can we find ways to do it? And it's never 100% accessible, but we're talking about, you know, my own tradition of Catholic Church, which is thousands of years old, and they have a lot to say on many of these issues. You know, unfortunately, it oftentimes gets lost in oftentimes sort of not very productive debates over hot button issues. But you know, the church's teaching on social justice is magnificent. I mean, it has some incredible lessons for hopefully post-pandemic world.
Right.
So let's find a way to engage with that. But to your point, are there going to be areas of disagreement? Of course. Are there going to be areas where we need debate and deliberation? Of course. But, you know, and spoiler alert to you and other students in the class, we'll be discussing this a little later in the term. There are ways to do that. There are ways to actually engage in deliberation, and there are ways to simply call out the other side as being wrong and evil and needing to mend their ways. And you know, I think there are approaches where you can actually try to figure some stuff out together. And to go back to Bretherton, you know, find this common life, deal with these problems in a common way. And of course, there's always going to be differences, but that's the nature of humanity.
So from a student aspect, how can a student apply public ethics to their own lives? How does it impact them?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, you know, I say in the poor you, it's sort of like you're sitting through the class twice, but if it's about bringing your beliefs to the world, I think the first step is trying to understand what you believe. And I don't mean that in a patronizing way or all of us, I think, have to figure out what it is we believe. What is it that we believe on in terms of how the world works?
Right.
You know, we talk a lot in the course about a worldview, and that may seem a little abstract to people, but all of us have an understanding of how the world works. You know, to go into political, this is a political podcast. Anyone who follows US politics very closely, I don't even think you have to follow it there very closely. You could tell me how Bernie Sanders thinks the world works.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Bernie Sanders thinks the world is rigged.
Right.
Say the world, but the United States is dominated by, and he has probably has a very valid point, by folks at the top, big corporations, rich people, and the system is rigged against those at the bottom in their favor. They don't pay a lot of tax, they're not overly regulated, you know, they have an understanding of how the world works. And you know what, and I dare not go there because we'll use up all the time plus more if we say Donald Trump. How does he think?
Well, that's the other side of the spectrum, right? Yeah. Of populism, for sure.
Yeah, so you can understand how the world works. So you have to think about, how do you understand the world works? You know, on my first day of class, I give the students a questionnaire, private questionnaire. They don't share it with anyone. It's just to get them thinking. And, you know, I ask, do we live in a world where if you work hard, you can get ahead?
Right.
Do we live in a world where, you know, people who are on social assistance should take some responsibility for getting off of it? Or is the system rigged against them? You know, you have all these lists of questions. What do we owe each other is one of my favorite questions. And again, you can think of it from a personal point of view, but from a public policy point of view, what do we owe each other? Should we be paying, you know, a bit of a history lesson here. There are times when there have been times when the top tax bracket in many Western countries has been phenomenal, 70-80%. You know, I remember in Britain, I think they had an inheritance tax, which basically you lost everything. But you know, there's another side to that. That money was redistributed. So do we want that? Anyway, it's building that, what do I believe? And then I think it doesn't have to be figure out what I'm going to believe. I'll take 3 weeks and do that, and you know, nothing else in between. I mean, it's not necessarily a two-step. I mean, it sort of melds together. But I'll put it that way, as you're figuring out what you believe, then it becomes a question of, well, then how do I understand what's going on in the world today? How do I approach the fact that we have a homelessness problem in Waterloo Region, we have a opioid addiction problem, we have huge concerns over racism, over Indigenous reconciliation. How do I bring these beliefs that I've started to think through to them? And you know what? It can't be a knee-jerk reaction. can't be, God bless Twitter and Facebook and everything. It can't be just, you know, reacting to a tweet or react. You've got to start to understand these issues. You've got to start to really delve into them, understand the history, the context, the public policy options. And then, you know, as I say, bring those beliefs that you have to the table and start to figure them out. So it's a process, but it's a really good process, and it's an important process. But part of it is really trying to get you to understand how you think the world works, what your worldview is, what are the values. If you are from a faith tradition, what's that faith tradition all about? And of course, it's not a process with a beginning, middle, and end. It's always a circular process, because, you know, I've already identified myself as a Roman Catholic. As a Roman Catholic, confront poverty in my community and work through all the steps I've talked about, by the end of it, I'm going to probably have new insights and want to go back and rethink things. And
absolutely,
you know, that's hopefully the process that you'll adopt as you move forward.
Yeah. So it's important to have an individual self-awareness of your own ethical values before we can bring it into the public square.
Yeah. But as I say, you're never going to have that point where you say, okay, I got it all figured out. Now I can confront poverty.
Right.
And I mean, that's part of the challenge.
Yeah. But the public square, I mean, as we have briefly touched on in quite a few lectures, is you get to debate those values and challenge those values, I think is really important and integral to our understanding of ourselves, is to not just believe that we are right and it is true, right? Is to challenge it.
Yeah, and you have to be self-critical.
Absolutely.
You really do. And unfortunately, we live in a time that it's not exactly in fashion to be self-critical. So
Maybe this interview will change it.
Well, it's always in fashion to be critical of everybody else, but self-criticism is out of fashion.
So. Right. We talked a little bit about your political activism, but why is it important for students to be a part of the conversation? Why is it important for students to be politically active?
Well, I think it's funny. I have a 16-year-old son who keeps telling me it's more important for him to be involved than me to be involved because I'm old. And there's some truth to that.
Right.
You know, the challenges facing our world, and obviously the one that comes to mind right away is the climate crisis, but other major issues that are facing us, we need to either sort them out now or we're going to pay for it later. And it's going to be students who will be paying for it, sometimes literally paying for it, yes. Or paying for it in the sense of a planet in crisis. So, you know, I think there's a huge role that young people can play in the political system, and it is actually tragic that we don't see those numbers around voter turnout for younger people, that it's not sort of 80-90% kind of thing, because they have such a stake in the future. At the same time, I think there's so much passion and energy and ideas coming from young people, and cliche alert again, all those things are true. You get the type of government you vote for or you don't vote for.
Absolutely.
And some of those statistics are always scary. The don't vote, if there was a don't vote party, they would have won majorities in any government. So get involved. At the same time, you have to realize you're voting for human beings that are flawed, in systems that are flawed, and a government that can't do everything, but your voice needs to be heard.
Yeah, so not only a self-awareness, but a systematic and institutional awareness of the maybe negatives of our system and how we should make that change. And I also think that there's a issue in my generation of instant gratification, but these deep issues that you we touched on briefly, systemic racism, for example, or the climate crisis, they take transgenerational solutions. It needs to be a long-term thing, not just short-term.
Oh, definitely. And it does. At the same time, you know, you also have to recognize there has been progress made in all these files. And
absolutely.
You know, I think sometimes there's a pessimism out there. We have made progress as a society on all these fronts. And in some files, the fact that we're even having this discussion is progress. And that's not a throwaway line. It's huge progress that there's an awareness about it. Issues around, you know, Indigenous reconciliation or race, they were not talked about the same way they are today, with the same urgency and the same fluency, even 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, I would argue even pre-COVID. I think that there's been many strides for the awareness of systematic racism in Canada, especially in the last 2 years.
So I think, you know, now's the time to continue the conversation, but that's going to require, you know, the old joke, most of life is just showing up, but you have to show up.
Absolutely. So wrapping up a little bit, where can students contact you, or you are an author, so where can students read your latest work and see more of your ideas come to life?
That's shameless, me plugging my new book.
Oh, come on, you have to.
Well, first of all, where they can see me, for political science students, and I don't check ID, I mean, I've talked to non-political science students as a practitioner in residence, but I am in the political science department. Obviously reachable by email, M-I-L-L-O-Y is the way I spell my last name. So, and it can have nothing to do, this, you know, faith and all that stuff is part of my journey. So if you know, if you're not comfortable, and I know students may have no interest in it, but still want to talk about politics and government, about working in government, working in politics, getting involved in campaigns, even some of the public policy research you're doing, please, you know, in this COVID day and age, unfortunately, I have to say, send me an email, and most of it's being done by Zoom, but hopefully in January, I will physically be around in the political science department, and I have an office there. On the Luther side, again, it's the same email. We're part of the Laurier family, but you know, I maintain an office there, and I teach there, and I'm certainly again very happy to meet with students. Obviously, meet with those in the program, but also meet with students who have an interest in this area. In terms of my own work, I wrote a popular, I don't know if popular, it's not John Grisham, I don't think is worried, but it's accessible, it's not overly academic, a book on faith and politics from my own perspective, the Roman Catholic perspective, which you know, I think there's lots in there for people who aren't Catholic as well, but I wanted to sort of pick a vantage point, and it's called Politics and Faith in a Polarized World, a Challenge for Catholics. And it's published by they're an international publishing firm, but they're based in Toronto, Novalis, and is available, listen to me, I'm shameless, but yeah, obviously available through Novalis, available on Amazon and other places, but also locally, Wordsworth Books over on King Street is carrying it. So, you know, it's about 120 pages, but it covers actually a lot of the themes that we've been talked about, that we're talking about today, this sort of post-COVID world and how do we engage faith? And it's, you know, to go back to something I said earlier, there's a level of self-criticism in it about the Catholic faith and the fact that it has become so tied up, I guess, with issues around abortion or same-sex marriage and things like that. And yet there are so many important issues where we're not hearing the voice of Catholicism. And yes, I actually do tackle a little bit some of those hot button issues, and so far have survived doing that. But It's a much more holistic view of this intersection between faith and politics. So that's my most recent publication that's come out, and I think for anyone interested in the whole area, it would be interesting to take a look at.
Absolutely, yeah. If they wanted to continue understanding your ideas and continue to educate themselves on some of the issues that we touched on today, I think that it would be a great read. Thank you again, Dr. Molloy, for agreeing to be on The Political Impact. I myself, Kelsey Hickman, and Radio Laurier, thank you for your time today.
Great, thank you.